Welcome back to Against the Grain. My name is Dr. Samir Kakodkar. I'm a gastroenterologist and specialist in ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease. If you have any questions about this podcast or want to make an appointment or talk to me about specifically your case, you can send me an email at samir3@gmail.com. That's samir3@gmail.com. If you have Crohn's or colitis, I bet you've encountered someone, either in person or on the internet, who claims to be able to control his or her disease with the use of cannabis. This may seem appealing as an alternative to medications that could have a frightening side effect profile. The regulatory climate in the U.S. makes marijuana difficult to study, so we don't have good, high-quality information about it regarding its effect on IBD. The Crohn's and Colitis Foundation commissioned a white paper on this topic titled "The Role of Cannabis in the Management of Inflammatory Bowel Disease, a Review of Clinical, Scientific, and Regulatory Information." This was published in the journal Inflammatory Bowel Disease in February of 2019. Dr. Arun Swaminath is the first author on this paper and also an IBD specialist in New York. This is a great interview where I hope we address any and all questions you may have about cannabis and IBD. As a disclaimer, this podcast is not medical advice, and I am not endorsing the use of cannabis for IBD, as it has not been FDA approved for this purpose. So today we have Dr. Arun Swaminath, who is going to talk to us about cannabis and marijuana and its use in inflammatory bowel disease. And the reason I reached out to him is he published a recent study. This was just recently was published. The role of cannabis in the management of inflammatory bowel disease: a review of clinical, scientific, and regulatory information. And he's the first author on that. So, and this was this commissioned by like the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation?
Yeah, well, Samir, thank you for having me on your podcast. So this was largely driven by several people at the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation, Laura Wingate and Sarah Buchanan to start. And they got David Rubin, who, as you know, is the chief at the University of Chicago and is a passionate advocate of patients with inflammatory bowel disease. And he was sort of the mastermind of the group. And so we had a really talented set of co-authors putting this paper together. And I would describe it as a white paper. It was really a chance to figure out what we know and what the data is and where to understand sort of where the holes are so that the research can be directed to filling those gaps.
Great. So, you know, before we get started and really dig into it, I was wondering if you can just give us kind of like a thumbnail CV of your background and where you work now.
Sure. I'm mainly grew up in Southern California. I did all my training at UC San Diego, where my heart still is. But I did my IBD research training at Mount Sinai, New York for a year. And then for the last 10 years, I've been taking care of patients as well as doing clinical research. I'm currently an associate professor of medicine. I work at Lenox Hill on the Upper East Side in New York City, which is part of a healthcare system called Northwell Health.
Great. And I really appreciate you being on today because I know you're battling a cold and maybe sipping some tea in between answering these questions. But thanks so much for making time despite not feeling the best.
You're very welcome, and I hope you don't mind me having a little tea during our chat.
Yeah, absolutely. So how did you particularly get involved in writing this kind of official white paper commissioned by the CCF or Crohn's and Colitis Foundation on marijuana? Is this something you had interest in prior to this, or were you kind of just tasked with figuring out the current status of the research?
Yeah, no, I can't say that I have any special expertise in marijuana research. But I do have expertise in managing patients with inflammatory bowel disease. And David Rubin, I think, was essentially finding a group of people that would be very nice as representatives from around the country and to have the right sort of stakeholders. One of the authors, Eric Berlin, is a lawyer at Jones Day with deep expertise in the evolving status of marijuana across the U.S. Adam Chaffetz, who's at Beth Israel at Harvard, Ed Hoffenberg, who's a pediatric GI in Colorado, Jamie Kanukin, who's an amazing adult gastroenterologist at the University of Michigan. So, you know, the team, I think, brings a lot of experience and talent and sort of desire to figure out what do we know and what do we need to know to be able to guide our patients in this sort of rapidly evolving landscape.
Can you briefly discuss the chemistry and physiology of cannabis and, you know, regarding the different components of it and its known effects on the body?
Yeah, I mean, this is actually, you would think that we have the answers to this completely, but when I was essentially doing the research to see what we know, there's a deep well of information, but it's not very clear, you know, how much is sort of broadly applicable. So what I'm going to say, I have to admit, is sort of a simplified version of the data out there, but just to sort of give a mental framework for people to have. So if you think of this, the whole system as the endocannabinoid system, and it's driven by two receptors, CB1, CB2, and these are naturally occurring in the body, which means that there are molecules that naturally plug into those receptors and activate the downstream effects. In the body, the natural sort of molecules that bind into those receptors are anandamide and 2-acylglycerol or 2-AG. And what's interesting is that THC is considered a partial agonist to both of those receptors. So it's almost like having anandamide or 2-acylglycerol weakly activating both of those receptors. And CBD, again, this is a simplified model, seems to prevent the reuptake of anandamide and 2-acylglycerol. So instead of it being sort of digested and broken down, that these molecules hang out longer and have a longer period of time where they're activating these receptors.
And do you have any sense of these endogenous cannabinoids that you mentioned? You know, do we know what naturally stimulates those to be released, and what, like, as far as physiologically, what is their purpose?
Yeah, I think the short answer is we're not entirely sure. I think when you look at the breadth of publications, it's everything sort of from cancer and cell replication to neurology and psychiatry, looking at memory and happiness and emotion. So it's sort of a massive, massive bit of data. And so to try to say that this is exactly what sets off the body to produce this and release this in these situations would be, you know, it's sort of not within my scientific purview. Mm-hmm. What people have done, though, is that they've tried to figure out how it applies directly to IBD, and the way that you can have some control is to do animal models, and I'm happy to talk about that if that's something that your listeners would be interested in. Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, if you can go into a little bit more detail about what they've found in animal models.
So you can think of both of these receptors as having effects on the gut, in addition to numerous other places, i.e. the brain. But in the gut, activation of CB1 relaxes the esophageal sphincter, it decreases acid secretion, it decreases visceral pain and inflammation. CB2 seems to decrease visceral pain and inflammation, and also decreases gut motility, especially in an inflamed gut. So when you look at it in animal models, there was actually a systematic review published just last year in the IBD journal, and it looks like a home run in terms of having all of the different types of mouse models that replicate colitis that might be the basis for human experiments. And almost no matter what you do, whether it's a, you know, TNBS, a DSS mouse model, a carbon monoxide injury model, an NSAID injury model, that activating CB1 and CB2 seems to have a potent anti-inflammatory effect. And this is sort of irrespective of the way that you measure this. So you can look at how the colon actually looks in a mouse that's been treated this way. You can measure blood anti-TNF levels. You can do disease activity scores. Whatever way you're doing it, it looks like the inflammation is improved by having these receptors activated. And it doesn't seem to matter whether it's CB1, CB2, whether it's a little upstream or downstream, that all of it seems good. So, you know, I think once we get into the human data, it's going to be a little bit surprising that what looks like a home run in a mouse model hasn't been a home run in humans yet.
Yeah, that is a frustrating part of looking at drug targets and the different, you know, drugs that are in the pipeline as far as waiting for approval and figuring out different mechanisms that may work. And it may seem perfect on paper and even on mouse models, but a lot of times that doesn't translate to humans, and when it's studied in humans and we don't see the same effect. Because, the physiology, though mice and humans are mammals, there's still a lot of difference. Which I've observed as well. And even in the kind of the alternative medicine realm, there's things that people try that, you know, based on in vitro studies or animal studies, the mechanism may work. You know, I did a podcast a couple months ago on baking soda, and now there's theoretical mechanisms of how it can be anti-inflammatory. And there's, you know, tons of food supplements, tons of even food itself. But as far as the effect on humans who actually have diagnosed IBD, that's kind of a different animal. And a lot of times things don't pan out as we expect.
Right. And I think, you know, there's depending on the subject, there's always a group of people, I think, that are just so excited about it and really want it to be a certain way. And to some degree, I think if we look at it as cold, hard data that there are things we still don't understand, and we're not quite sure why there's this disconnect, as you said, between the animal models and the effects that we've been seeing in human patients with IBD.
So there's two forms, right, of, you know, everyone talks about the THC and the cannabidiol, and different forms of cannabis have different varying amounts of these. Can you just briefly go over that and the significance of that?
Sure. I mean, I think, you know, the things that are in marijuana, the plant, are actually a huge number of things. The most famous is THC, which gives you the psychotropic effect, so essentially feeling high, feeling good. But CBD is a piece. And then there are other molecules that I think are less popular, less well known, and less well studied. And I'll throw out one, which is terpenes. But essentially, I think we are simplifying. And for most sort of commercial purposes, there are two things that people talk about. One is THC content, and the other is CBD content. I think the simplified version would be that THC would have benefits in improving mood, decreasing stress, increasing appetite, decreasing pain. And CBD probably would have the most activity as sort of clinically apparent activity as decreasing motility. So patients with diarrhea especially may find that they have fewer bowel movements using CBD.
Is there a particular form of cannabis that you've noticed in your clinical practice or in your review of the research that may make more sense or is just being more utilized?
So, you know, what's interesting is that, all of this stuff is being measured in the sense that the industry is essentially, because of its disconnect between the state and federal government, so where the federal government essentially considers marijuana to have no value and a high risk of abuse and is considered Schedule One, versus numerous states now which have sort of disagreed and said, we think marijuana either has a medical use and it's approved as a medication under certain circumstances, and it's unique to each state. And then some states, for example, Colorado and California, where it's available to anyone as a recreational use. So that being said, so when you look at how people are imbibing the products that are out there, it turns out that inhalation, so cigarettes, are becoming less and less popular, but vaping is becoming very popular as a mode of delivery. I've had patients who use oil extracts and either, swallow pills with the oil in it or mix it into food. And, you know, there are all sorts of lozenges and other ways to sort of deliver this, but I think vaping is pretty big, and I think the oil extracts are pretty big right now.
I did meet somebody at a conference, a patient, who and she had ulcerative proctitis and was using cannabis in the form of a suppository. And she was at least maintaining symptomatic remission using that. And she did tell me the dispensary she used was formulating it in this way. So I'm not sure if that's a widespread thing or if that was just the particular place she went to.
You're telling me something I haven't heard yet, but I think that it's fair to sort of describe this marketplace as the Wild West. And the companies that are coming out with products, I think, are being very creative and trying to meet the needs of their customers. And I think the people who are interested in using the product seem very open-minded and trying different things. So if you go back a step and say, could it be logical that a patient could benefit from that mode of delivery? As I mentioned, if the product contains any CBD, and essentially the CBD comes into contontact with the CB receptors, that you can see decrease in motility. So if the claim is a benefit of decrease in stool frequency, I think that's believable.
Yeah, and I heard that there are molds that are also sold online where people are making suppositories on their own as well, and just buying the mold and coming up with some formulation and forming a suppository out of it and using it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's not so different than when fecal transplant sort of had its, you know, really time in the popular press. And people were doing home fecal transplants, for example, and there were YouTube channels dedicated to how to do such a thing. I think the market and interest in marijuana-type products, marijuana-containing products, is even bigger. So while I haven't heard the things that you've mentioned to me, I'm utterly not shocked that they exist.
Yeah, I mean, patients get real creative with coming up with different ways to especially utilize this. And there's this other thing that I've heard of, this Rick Simpson's CBD oil. It's another kind of thing that gets thrown out. That's been this Rick Simpson came up with this kind of way to make this really concentrated CBD oil, which I think has a high THC concentration, used in the kind of alternative cancer realm. But also I've heard of some people using it for Crohn's. So that's just another form that's out there that I honestly don't know much about, but I've just heard people talking about it.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is that because of its legal status, where it's legal within a state but not legal within the federal government, that essentially all of the sort of purveyors of this product have to have a vertically, sort of a vertical from top to bottom system of their own. I can't buy marijuana from Colorado and sell it in a state, you know, it's essentially interstate trafficking, right? Mm-hmm. So essentially, people have to figure out, they have to grow the plant, they have to harvest it, they have to purify it, they have to package it, and then they have to essentially create a product and a brand out of it. And that's happening at an individual level. I think it's gotten a sort of a turbo boost, if you will, of cash infusion, because initially all of the sort of the entrepreneurs in the field were struggling for access to cash because the banks wouldn't deal with them because they were afraid to lose their federal charter if they got involved in a sort of a drug scheme. And they didn't want to be accused of that. So now the money that's essentially coming in to fund these operations is venture capital. And you have to think that those guys are pretty smart. They know how to make more money.
Mm-hmm. Regarding the forms of cannabis, there is a form you can actually get over the counter, right? The CBD oil is made from hemp as opposed to marijuana, which are supposed to have mostly CBD, cannabidiol, and there's a form that's particularly popular amongst patients called Charlotte's Web, and I see that now available at grocery stores. And it's very expensive, but that's another popular form. Do you have patients who've used that?
Definitely. And I think that probably many patients are using, if not that exact product or marijuana type of product. And I always find that my colleagues are surprised how many of my patients use a product like this. And I'm always thinking that actually all of your patients are using, I mean, it's not that I have a high fraction. I think there's a high fraction of patients using it. And you may want to ask because they might not be ready to share that with you, or they might feel judged or afraid that they're doing something bad. So it may be a thing that's quite common. And I think physicians have to be willing to communicate, ask, and be direct and non-judgmental and find out what's actually happening with their patients.
What is the issue with doing research on cannabis here in the U.S.? I know you said it's federally illegal, which I'm sure that's the main hurdle. But my understanding is that most of the research, at least the high-quality research, is being done in Israel as opposed to here. So why is that the case?
Yeah, so you're right. All of the human trials that have been published to date have come out of Israel, and that's because it's available through the Israeli government on a compassionate use basis, and so it's sort of highly regulated but is available, and so people can study it. In the U.S., as I mentioned, that the current Schedule I categorization essentially means that it doesn't really have – it's not considered to have a medical purpose and has a high risk of addiction potential. And so it's this very, very, very tightly regulated thing. Now, whether you agree with the characterization or not, it sort of doesn't matter because there have been many, many attempts to drop the schedule it's in to Schedule II or Schedule III, and it's never been successful. And I'm sure there are plenty of political moments where that has been tried and has been ineffective. And hence, the states have gotten ahead of the federal government. But because of its categorization, there's not like a place to get high quality, you know, marijuana product or THC or whichever thing you're looking to study. And it's very regulated. I think one place is the University of Mississippi that you have to sort of have a specific investigational new drug application that's approved by the FDA. You have to have funds that allow you to do research in this specific subject. So it becomes a very narrow talent pool that has access to anything in the U.S. Given what's happened in Canada recently with the legalization, I think the data is not just going to come out of Israel, but I actually think it's going to come out of Canada and other countries where it has sort of become legalized recently. So my guess would be that we are going to see data from outside the U.S. still, mainly because we're stuck in this bizarro world where it's sort of available in some places, but is technically illegal according to the federal government.
What is the legal status of it where you are in New York?
So in New York, it's available as a medical product under very specific guidelines. So there are a number of different illnesses or conditions for which it's approved, but there's sort of a two-step process in New York. First is that you have to have Crohn's or colitis, at least with respect to IBD. And the second part of it is that you have to have a patient who is not, who is symptomatic despite conventional therapy. So you've done everything you can, and there's still pain, weight loss, poor appetite, diarrhea, and then this can then be an option for those patients. And what's interesting is because we don't prescribe it, again, because it's not considered a medication. So what we end up, is using a word called certification. I certify that patients meet the New York State laws requirements and that they're a resident of the state in which they meet this criteria. And then the patient essentially takes that paperwork to a dispensary and then has access to whatever products are available through that dispensary.
Okay. Is that like an official type of paper form that needs to be signed, or is that something that you just kind of write on a prescription pad and certify that they have this.
It's very regulated. So to be able to do this, providers, which can be MDs, nurse practitioners, PharmDs, have to take an online course that's about 4 hours long that goes over the risks and benefits and the details, the law for New York. So once that sort of the provider becomes certified, there's a website through essentially the Department of Health, so the New York State Department of Health, where we certify a patient. The patient then goes in through a patient portal and essentially proves that they're a resident of the state and then prints out this thing, the certification letter. That certification letter they then take as the quote-unquote prescription to a dispensary for access.
And this is probably, this is not generalizable, right? This is a New York-specific protocol. It may be
exactly
different depending on what state somebody is in.
Absolutely.
I've also heard that some states say Crohn's is a most states do qualify Crohn's as an indication, but not necessarily ulcerative colitis. Is that true according to your research on this?
That is true, but I could not tell you for which states each one applies to. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, because it's state by state, the laws are not uniform and neither are the conditions which they cover. So it becomes a bit of a hodgepodge mess. And eventually, I think there's going to have to be something. Either it becomes legal across all of the states or the federal government decides that it's no longer a product that's so restricted. But right now, it's a mess. And I think that, you know, my knowledge base of how it works in New York may be completely useless outside of that state.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that the potency of marijuana over the years, over the decades, has increased. Is this something that has been proven, and why is that the case, and how is that going to affect the research going forward? Because it seems like we don't have a standardized product.
Yeah, as I said, because it's unregulated, you know, you're sort of depending on the essentially the person who's distributing the product to tell you how they do their processing and what the concentration is in each of their products. But there's no overarching authority to confirm that that information is correct, which is concerning because you'll recall, you know, it made the news. This is several years ago. The New York Attorney General raided, you know, health food supplement stores like GNC and Target and, you know, any number of big stores that sell wellness products, and essentially did analysis to see how many of these supplements contained the ingredients that they claimed. And the best case scenario was 40%. The worst case was something like 20%. Actually containing what was purported. So you can imagine that that under the right conditions that there could be gamesmanship of, you know, whether something actually contains the product that a patient is told is actually there.
And that's one of the strengths of having the FDA regulate, you know, conventional medications is you know what you're getting. So you can be pretty confident that what has been advertised is going to be in the pill or whatever mode of that you take
exactly
the medicine, you're going to getting what's promised.
And in the meantime, I think you're going to have to figure out who you trust and why you trust them. And, you know, maybe that's going to become an Amazon review type of situation to see if that's going to happen in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Your other question was about potency of marijuana. There was a publication in New England Journal of Medicine in 2014 that basically said that, you know, when you look at the seizures, so this is the Drug Enforcement Agency essentially stopping drugs that are being trafficked into the U.S., and specifically when it comes to marijuana, looking at the potency, meaning what is the fraction of THC in these samples. And so between 1995 and 2012, when they last had access to the data, it has gone up by threefold. So it's gone, you know, to the THC content has gone about from 4% to 12%. And the other side of that is that because the product has become more powerful, you're also seeing some of the side effects in people that use these products. One example is that they showed that the incidence of cannabinoid hyperemesis had gone up, and the incidence of cannabinoid dependence had gone up as well. So, you know, I think that there are very real implications to concentration and the effect that concentration can have on people.
I've always found that weird that, you know, some people use cannabis for nausea, and that can help with it, but then it's also associated with this hyperemesis or frequent vomiting or cyclic vomiting. So I have trouble trying to figure out why that would be the case.
This is absolutely true, and I don't know if you've seen this in your own practice, but we have seen an increase in cannabinoid hyperemesis, and this can be people vomiting, or this can be people showing up with severe abdominal pain. And, you know, if someone has Crohn's or colitis, you might confuse this for a flare of their underlying disease. So I probably make this diagnosis every 4 months now in a patient in the hospital, where you kind of don't understand what's happening because their labs are fine, their CT scan is okay or is unchanged from before. And then I think you have to gently ask the question, and then you can sometimes do a toxin screen to see if there's any marijuana in the system, and then start to get at the underlying problem. And the thing that you describe of confusion that marijuana can actually cause people to feel this way, it becomes a real challenge to explain to patients that it's the marijuana that's causing them to feel this badly. And there has to be trust on the patient's side that what you're saying is actually the truth, because it's going to take a while of completely stopping use before their symptoms resolve. So they really have to sort of commit to avoiding any exposures.
Yeah, I think for at least for some people, there may be this vicious cycle going on where they think the nausea, the marijuana is treating the nausea, and as a result, smoke more and just end up getting worse and worse.
I 100% agree with you. It's been a pet theory of mine as well, but I don't know how to prove that.
Yeah. So let's get to the main studies, the most high-quality studies, the randomized controlled trials, which were done by Naftali and colleagues.
Yeah.
Can you just briefly kind of give us the general conclusions or findings of those studies that were done? And those are the ones in Israel, right?
Right. Naftali is a gastroenterologist in Israel, and the work is coming out of Sheba Medical Center. And essentially, the short version is initially there were some observational studies that seemed promising in patients with IBD, and then it became a bigger thing, and so randomized trials were done. But the first set of randomized trials were with smoked cannabis cigarettes. And so there was a placebo group, and there was a treatment group, and the treatment group did amazingly well. You know, they didn't meet their primary endpoint, which was a big CDAI drop, essentially into remission. But over 90% had response, and you don't even see those kinds of numbers with biologic therapy. So it was rather amazing. But there were several things that sort of put pause to the enthusiasm. The first was that if you're smoking some paper versus smoking marijuana, you're going to be able to tell the difference. So it was, one of the criticisms was that a patient isn't really blinded because it's very obvious whether they're getting control product or real product. And second, which was the biggest thing, which is the people who felt so much better, some people were able to stop steroids, for example, and one person was able to stop their narcotic use, that within 2 weeks, all of stopping the cannabis, all of the patients had relapsed, all of them. So it's sort of shocking, because you really want to say that if it had an effect on inflammation, that even after stopping the product, that some of these folks would have a longer benefit. But the thinking behind the sense of improvement then, so then what explains feeling so much better, which is that the cannabis did its job. It did decrease pain, it did decrease diarrhea, and it did sort of improve people's mood. But in the end, it didn't have enough of an effect on inflammation to sort of change the true underlying process. And in that sense, the thinking was that you're essentially sort of covering up the symptoms when you may be feeling better than you were, but you haven't changed the biological activity of the underlying disease.
And what were the outcome measures they used for assessing inflammation?
So the initial study, and there was a subsequent study that was a development from the criticisms from this study, where so essentially they didn't have endoscopy. They had CDAI, which is a combination of lab results and physician evaluation, as well as some biomarkers. And the biomarkers didn't actually show any improvement. There was no colonoscopy, and everyone these days wants to see an improvement in the degree of inflammation in the mucosa. So there was a subsequent, and this is, again, only published as an abstract in ECHO, so the full paper isn't available for review. But the evolution was that, okay, now you have to do a study where you can give a product and the patient is truly blinded, so it can't be a cigarette, but it could be a pill containing THC and CBD, which is what happened. And then you measure all the blood biomarkers and stool biomarkers and colonoscopies. And in that study, which is really the landmark study, what they found was that there was absolutely no evidence of biomarker or colonoscopic improvement, but there was improvement in mood, decreased pain, decreased diarrhea, improved quality of life. So, the summary from that, which is sort of the Naftali, which was the lead author, said that, he thinks that cannabis and cannabis products have a supplementary role in treating patients with Crohn's, because that's the only group that they looked at, but probably doesn't have a primary role because it doesn't, so far, based on these still limited trials, doesn't show evidence that you've changed the biology of the underlying disease process.
Right. I think there is nowadays a huge emphasis on controlling inflammation, the whole treat-to-target strategy. But, symptoms are important, too, and sometimes that can get lost. It's very important that there's something out there that helps people feel better. And that's, from the patient's perspective, that's really why they're seeing their GI, is to feel better. And I know from our side of it, we want to see the colon healed because that leads to better long-term outcomes, less of a risk of surgery. But symptoms are still very important, so it was good to see that those particular things improved.
Yeah, I think, as physicians in this field, we haven't cured the disease. And there are a lot of patients who may not respond to standard therapies. And even for the patients that do respond, they never feel quite necessarily back to 100%, or there's at least a fraction of patients who I think don't come back to 100% and are looking for just something to sort of take the edge off of that persistent complaint. And so I think we, as physicians, we have to be healers. I think sometimes we have to use the tools that are available to us to figure out how to get a patient where they need to be.
What about the pharmaceutical industry? They're at least within the realm of patients who are looking for alternative treatments, because the reason this is attractive to people is, these biologics, these immunomodulators, their risk profile scares people, even though the risks are very rare. It scares people, and when they hear friends or other patients say that they were greatly helped by something like a plant, a natural thing that, we'll talk about the side effect profile next, but that's kind of the why people are so attracted to cannabis. It's kind of been billed as this potential cure, so-called cure, by patients who use it, and that's why it generates questions and people think, oh, could I potentially get through this just using cannabis as opposed to one of these infusions or injections. And I know there is some suspicion, and anytime the pharmaceutical industry is involved or has interest in something, and my understanding is that some companies are making products based on how cannabis affects inflammation. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, in general, I think it's, I use the word Wild West, and I think that is a fair characterization for what's out there. There is, along with hope, a lot of hype, And, you know, I've read different things in the lay press where there is, you know, people have sort of been afraid of the pharmaceutical medical industrial complex. But just like that, there is now a marijuana industrial complex. So, you know, it's sort of just because it's considered natural doesn't mean that it's not profiting somebody. So I think, you know, people should keep their eyes open about that, that that there's still a profit motive in our system. The second thing is that there's so much hype about CBD and other marijuana products that it's sort of hard to keep it all together. And there's this really awesome Mother Jones article from last year that's titled, "Sorry, Hipsters, CBD Will Not Solve All Your Problems. Don't Trust Everything You Read on the Internet." So I think people are starting to get clued into this, that, you know, that there's a lot of hype around this and that we should be careful. And the second thing is that just like anything that preceded this that was considered a natural therapy, people stop asking questions. And natural therapies are still made of something, and they have a scientific name that might sound scary if you used it, and they're still acting on a receptor, still acting on downstream effects, which means that they have side effects too. And it's sort of, I think, mentally, people have this construct like it's, quote, natural, it's hence safe, and hence I don't have to ask any questions, and hence this is a better thing for me to do than this pharmaceutical product. And it's sort of this leap of faith that's really happening, and people may not recognize it, that the things that physicians prescribe have been, you know, intimately studied, and people are, you know, if you've ever been part of a clinical trial, you know that patients, like, everything is measured and constantly monitored, and every week we're getting information. Every day patients are sending information about what's going on versus these other products that are outside of regulation where you don't have that sort of database to lean on. So, you know, I think that sort of just gets to the heart of it, that people think it's safe because it's natural, but I don't think that's a fair assumption to make.
Sure. Yeah, that totally makes sense, and I agree with that. That the we don't scrutinize the natural so-called remedies as much as we do with the pharmaceuticals, and it could be that they have a risk profile that, I mean, there could be things that we just don't realize are associated with these natural products, right. So-called natural products. Okay, so. Any other findings from these randomized controlled trials that are of relevance, or mainly it seems like symptoms, helps with symptoms, inflammation, not so much. Do you think we still need larger trials to really prove that point, or are we do we have enough data to really confidently say it's not affecting inflammation?
No, you know, I think, you know, it's fair to say everything that's been done, including this abstract that I mentioned, really only had 48 patients, so 20-some in the treatment arm and 27 in the placebo arm. So these are all very small trials, first. The second is that there's clearly a signal in the mouse models that show that something real is happening. So I think that we have not, you know, sort of gone the distance in understanding the physiology and figuring out maybe what is the right recipe, right fraction to sort of hit the sweet spot where you're actually affecting inflammation. So I think these are still very early days, and by no means do I not have enthusiasm for studying the product more in patients, but having science sort of lead the way in figuring out how to ask the question and how that question is going to be answered in the best way.
Now, I know anecdotal evidence is not evidence, and it's just on a kind of a case-by-case basis, but have you seen in your clinical practice any particular patients that come to mind where you're actually impressed? And then this is just, again, based on a anecdotal, but like a patient who was potentially on just refusing medicine, monotherapy, was just doing marijuana, and you saw a significant improvement in inflammation.
So I can't say that I've seen that in any patient of mine where there's actually been a reversal in their inflammation. I think most of my patients that are doing well use it as an adjunct to their current therapies. I think probably a few of my patients, at least that I know about, have stopped their therapies in favor of these alternative therapies. Some have not done well and some have done okay, but it's sort of a period of time where you're not sure if this is going to be a long-term effect or not. So I think the short answer to it is that I've not seen anyone with inflammation reverse from monotherapy from a cannabis-based product.
Okay. You know, when one patient comes to mind for me, it was somebody who was smoking marijuana pretty much on a daily basis and had a history of Crohn's, was pretty much lost to follow-up for several years, then came to see me. And, you know, she was mainly doing that to manage her pain. And I did a colonoscopy, had very severe, you know, Crohn's colitis with deep ulcers. And, you know, those, it can also work in the other direction, right? Like these anecdotal cases can kind of bias you and influence you. But that case in particular made me less confident in the anti-inflammatory effects of marijuana, but it shouldn't, you know, just because it's one case. And also severe disease, I mean, marijuana may just be an indicator, like the fact that she was using it, that she had severe disease and required some pain relief. And so that doesn't necessarily mean maybe in someone who had milder disease, it could have an effect. And I think we do get biased because even medications, we scope people on medications all the time, and they have ulcerations. Sure. But we still have data that they work compared to placebo. So I think we can get pushed one way or another based on our kind of like anecdotal clinical experience.
Yeah, I think it's hard because the bar for what we consider effective has really been raised over the last 20 years or so, right? We used to be satisfied when a patient had less symptoms or no symptoms, and that was considered sort of good. You know, you got where you were going. And now we want to see so much more. We want to see all the blood tests and stool tests normalized. We want to see their colonoscopy come back to totally normal, which is a really high bar. And so I think if you sort of think about this in a, you know, period of time, like, you know, 30 years ago, this might have been considered fantastic because you kind of got to this endpoint where people were feeling better. But I think now we want to see something much different because we know that when people get to this deep level of healing, that they do better over the long term. And if you're taking care of young people with a chronic disease, you are in it for the long term, and whatever you're doing should help them for the long term. So I think that even if people feel better in the short term, that we really need to, as physicians, help them understand that we need to have them on something that changes the biology. And, you know, it's I think it's unfortunate. It would have been nice to run clinical trials in the U.S. because I'm sure there would be no shortage of patients who are interested in joining a clinical trial with a marijuana-derived product. But it's unfortunate that we can't do it just the way we would for any other medical product.
So finally, you know, I don't want to take too much of your time this evening, but I wanted to just talk about the risks of marijuana. What do we know as far as the long-term effects, and what do people have to be worried about when using it?
Yeah, so these are not... these are not nothing. And I think that people are surprised when we talk about the risk of dependence or addiction, which it turns out is about 9% in adult users of cannabis. In adolescence, you can almost double that. So there is a real concern about dependence. The second thing is that we know that patients seem to have a... especially in patients who have a psychosis history or any history of schizophrenia, that cannabis use can uncover that and can result in delusions or paranoia. And so this is something that I look for, that I, in patients where I'm considering this, I ask this question to make sure that they don't have any of these risk factors, because I don't think that's the right patient to try this in. And finally, there's also really good evidence, especially if you're smoking marijuana, that it causes chronic bronchitis, which I don't think is a great thing. And that there's lots of data to show that people who are long-term cannabis users actually have diminished life satisfaction and achievement overall. So I think, you know, you have to sort of put this stuff in context and say that there are clearly some risks. And is this the best approach to what we're trying to achieve? And I think you just have to ask that question with each patient.
A few additional things I've heard of is that it may increase the progression to cirrhosis for people with hepatitis C.
Interesting.
And I actually just heard, you know, I do listen to other podcasts. There was the Joe Rogan podcast. They had a debate on cannabis between someone who was very pro cannabis with medical use and somebody who was against it. And the guy who was against cannabis was talking about a potentially increasing violence. And he did mention the psychosis thing as well. And they did talk about a few kind of anecdotal cases where people kind of were pretty normal, and then they smoked marijuana and ended up getting, you know, a really bad case of schizophrenia, and it's unclear if those cases, if there was some of that going on beforehand, but definitely the marijuana didn't help as far as making it worse.
Yeah.
So there are those risks. They're rare, you know, just like the side effects of the conventional medications are rare. But they do exist. So, you know, taking into account all of what you know over your clinical practice and after preparing this paper, what conclusion have you come to as far as, like, a patient comes to you and asks about marijuana? How does it fit into your algorithm at this point?
Sure, and I would want to clarify, this is my personal opinion as opposed to me speaking for the foundation,
right?
Whose paper we're referencing, but the way that I use it in my practice, given the available data, is that I don't use it as primary therapy, and I discourage patients from avoiding standard therapies and substituting this as their primary therapy. If a patient intends to do that, what I do is to say, let's put you in some type of a true monitoring protocol to make sure things don't go completely off the rails. And that may mean blood and stool tests every few months to see if there's any worsening in those numbers, and occasionally colonoscopies to see if there's any worsening in the obvious visible disease. So I would do that. I mean, I would do that as an advocate for the patient, as opposed to, I think this is the right thing to do. And then the general way that I think I use it is probably in agreement with what Naftali describes, which is as an adjunct therapy for patients who are on therapy, whose therapy has been optimized, and you may need to add a second drug to get where you're going. So maybe on combination therapy, and that second drug is optimized, and everything is sort of in the box that it's supposed to be in, and yet a patient has some symptoms that I think cannabis could help with. And in those situations, I think it's worth a real discussion, and you go over the risks and benefits just like you do with any conventional therapy. And I think that there are a fraction of patients who I've seen that are really helped by having this adjunctive therapy.
Are there restrictions on the kind of patient you would give it to, as far as, let's say, somebody is a pilot or a construction worker operating heavy machinery, something like that? Does that go into your decision making?
Yeah, you know, the hard part is that, you know, I think you have to let people have a little bit of common sense in this, and people have to take responsibility for themselves. But there is no easy way, you know, you can, and the other thing I should have mentioned when we were talking about risks is an increase in motor vehicle accidents, especially if it's combined with alcohol, right? Yeah. So you can imagine if someone is a truck driver or in a car all the time for their job, or is involved in operating machinery, that this is not a good thing. And the metabolism of the drug is complicated by the method of delivery the frequency of use and the intensity of the product and how much THC it contains. So there's no like easy formula, although if you go online, there's a number of calculators that kind of tell you when this stuff is in your system and when it might be detected in a drug test, et cetera. So I think there's all of that, but it becomes very complicated, I think, as a physician to try to counsel someone on this. And to some degree, I think I have a general statement, but I think people need to be responsible for themselves. That being said, because of its, you know, legal limbo status, there's no clearinghouse for good information for people to like go find it and say this is dependable good information, and this is what you should base it on. And so I think this is one of the, you know, the great boons of the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation having become curious enough to write a white paper on this subject, which is that we're starting to see where these huge gaps are and the things that patients need, things that physicians need to be able to counsel patients properly. And so at least we know what we're starting to do next.
Great, great. Yeah, and I just one comment from my side is I think the way people can get in trouble, I think mainly from using cannabis in IBD, is they use it, as you said, and it helps their symptoms, and then they ignore, they'll stop seeing their GI, they'll kind of, you know, not get lost to follow-up, not be on medical therapy, and as a result, this inflammation starts brewing, they get
right.
strictures, fistulas, perforations, and then they get in trouble. So that's where I see the main problem, is it masks, it may mask the symptoms, and
absolutely.
Then you don't get on the appropriate therapy that's really more targeted towards the inflammation, and then you can get in trouble. And I've seen that time and again.
And the big thing is that very often Crohn's is so slowly progressive that the patient might think everything is totally fine until things get so bad that they're actually symptomatic. But then it's taken potentially already many years to get where that's going and may not even be reversible with medical therapy. So I think the idea that, oh, I've been fine for months on this and nothing bad has happened, that might just be way too short a time to realize something bad is actually happening, which is that the disease is progressing. So, you know, I think that in those rare cases where patients really want to try this as monotherapy, that it's our job to sort of stay involved and also to help guide the patient. So say, let's follow CRPs or fecal calprotectins or colonoscopies to see what's happening and say like, okay, at some point you have to decide, just like any other therapy, that this is effective or ineffective.
Right. Right. And another way, you know, you mentioned Crohn's is slowly progressive. Another circumstance where I see there being some confusion is in de-escalation of therapy. Usually it's voluntarily, and somebody who responds very well to
right.
something like infliximab or Remicade, they stop the medicine and they expect that they're going to flare immediately after doing that if the medicine was doing anything for them in the first
right.
place. But what people have to understand is when you heal the colon and you potentially stop the medicine, usually your GI is not recommending that. It's more on the patient side.
Right.
It can take months to end up flaring again if that's going to happen, which over multiple years, it seems like the majority of people do eventually. So that's just another thing to keep in mind. These medicines, once they heal things, it can take a while for you to flare again after stopping it if that's going to happen.
I mean, I think that also gives you a real nice way to compare the difference in the duration of benefit in something that's changed the biology versus not. So when you looked at these patients that hit, you know, mucosal healing and then stopped their biologic therapy, about 50% would eventually end up flaring within 5 years and then probably a third within the first year. But we're not talking about 2 weeks and then flaring. We're talking about a year or longer, sometimes up to 5 years, sometimes even longer. So when you look at what happened in the Naftali study and people sort of felt great and then fell off, you know, this good feeling within a couple of weeks of stopping the therapy, it really gives you that clear difference between something that changes the biology and something that doesn't.
Right. Great. So thank you, Arun, for your time. And, you know, I think this is going to be a blockbuster podcast, because this topic is so much in the psyche of IBD patients recently. I've noticed it. I get this question all the time. So I think this is going to be very informative. I think we gave very solid evidence-based kind of advice on this topic. And I know your clinical practice is yours, but this white paper, which I encourage people to read if they can look it up, to really get into what we know based on evidence, and then people can make a decision on their own as far as if they think this is valuable or not. So thanks again for your time. I'll give you the last word. Is there anything else you'd like to mention just to
no,
kind of
Samir,
take us
thank
out?
Thank you for having me. The paper is going to be published formally in the IBD Journal in March of this year, but is available online and is open access for anyone who's interested.
Okay, great. Everybody check that out for sure once it comes out, or you can check it now online. But again, Arun, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Samir. Bye-bye.